Okay, we're back with Can't Wait. And as I mentioned before, there's no Nick Prevenis with us this week. It's me, Rusty, as your impromptu host with the brothers Milner, Matt and Tim. And this third segment, we're going to talk about the NBA playoffs. The first round just wrapped up last night. The last game was played. One of the great all-time first-round series, one of the great first-round games even to finish off. I mean, that was a phenomenal Game 7. But what I think we'll start with is, what are your takeaways? What do you think is what you see in the first round that makes you intrigued for the second and moving forward?
Well, I think that even though there were a lot of great teams in the first round, there weren't a lot of great series necessarily. I mean, that Clippers-Spurs one was more the exception than anything else. But I think that the biggest takeaway for me is that as much as people want to be able to find a reason to generate drama and uncertainty, that more so than ever, I think it's clear that barring injuries, this postseason is just the prolonged coronation of the Warriors. I do not think that there is any team out there that has a realistic chance of being able to push them to the brink. I think the Warriors are going to get to the finals without having really been tested. And I think that especially now that the Cavs are without Kevin Love, I don't think there's a team left in the field that has a realistic chance of being able to beat the Warriors.
And Tim, your takeaway from the first round?
I agree with all of that. I would say that overall my biggest takeaway was a little bit of disappointment that we didn't get more great first round series, but that for the one that we did get, I think we can all agree that we were pretty blown away. To see the Spurs, the dynasty, go up against this Clippers team, and to have it end with a one-footed injured Chris Paul shot, it was pretty cinematic.
That's a great way to describe it. It was cinematic not only because of the drama of the ending, but also along the way, it seemed like every game had its own dramatic quality to it. That,
right.
You know, you had the DeAndre Jordan basket interference call that is one that you'll probably be able to just describe as the basket interference game, and people will know what you're talking about. You had the fact that both of these teams were able to steal games from the home court of the other team. And then also the Clippers exercising some of their demons of being able to finally pull themselves together, not get flustered, and actually finish off a series despite continuing to be so flappable. I mean, it's not like they really turned a corner and became a new team, but they managed to at least keep it enough under control that they didn't just have a meltdown.
Yeah, no, I think you guys are dead on with that. And that is the main takeaway, I think, is that Spurs-Clippers series. And in fact, going in a couple weeks ago, we talked about it, and I didn't give the Clippers much of a chance. I really thought that Tim Duncan, even though he was 39, was going to beat up some 20-year-olds. And it was really amazing to see Blake Griffin round into – he's always had all the potential in the world to be one of the great players. All at once now, he looks like he's there to me. He had a triple-double last night with 10 assists, and I think that that's a really – the Clippers now, they were swept in the second round 2 years ago by San Antonio, and that is another cinematic quality, and kind of the poetry of the NBA playoffs that we've talked about before is here they come, and they get to take out the people that have been beating them and the best in the last decade, probably the best team in the NBA. And now the Clippers, I agree with you completely, Matt. Golden State looks, I don't know who challenges them really all that well, but the Clippers do look really cool, and it's going to be interesting to see, but Chris Paul being a little hampered by injury might certainly be a downfall for them. They face Houston in the next round, which is a fairly intriguing matchup to me. I know that our buddy Nick, who's not here, really hates Houston.
As does any red-blooded American, I think. I mean, honestly, the Houston Clippers series, those are probably the two easiest to hate teams in the league. The Clippers are whiners and complainers, and, you know, like Chris Paul is the dirtiest player in the league, and probably somehow manages to get away with like 11 flagrant fouls per game that never get called. And then the Rockets, you know, have a really unwatchable style that spent, you know, spent half the game at the free throw line, and Dwight Howard is insufferable. And, you know, James Harden is a Sun Devil, so he's got that going against him. Yeah. So, you know, I guess the saving grace is that the Clippers, at least, there's always drama whenever the Clippers are involved one way or the other.
That's true. That's true. And Golden State, as we've been talking here, Golden State put away Memphis in the first game of their series. And I don't think, I mean, it looks a little intriguing, but without Conley, I don't know how far Memphis could really even push Golden State.
Yeah, I don't see it happening. I think that with where the Grizzlies are at right now, you get this feeling that it's pretty much in the same spot that they've been the past few years.
Yeah.
That they get to the second round. They've looked great throughout the whole regular season. But it just doesn't feel different this year.
And it's funny because they had earlier in the regular season, it looked like this was maybe the best Grizzly team yet. And for most of the year, they were in the second spot. Mike Conley had really turned into one of the better point guards in the Western Conference, and they were firing all cylinders. But due to a combination, I think, of injuries and then some other guys kind of coming back down to earth, I think that they're going to really struggle. It's a tough matchup as well, because the Warriors are a team that's able to grit it out and play tough defense and get and bang with Memphis, but they can also just run them off the court, and that happened
Absolutely.
A little bit today.
Yes.
Okay, and so then we have what I think is the most intriguing matchup of the second round is Cleveland versus Chicago. I originally had Cleveland here. It's still going to be a really good series. Cleveland has some pieces to me that even without Kevin Love, that their bench can. If I were playing them with a video game, I think I could beat Chicago pretty well, even without Kevin Love, because I think they've got enough movable pieces. Sean Marion he's not going to be a great player for you, but he's a player that could fill three different positions for you if you need to. LeBron James could too, as far as that goes. You could play him at power forward if you wanted.
I think that they have to commit to playing LeBron at the four for at least 75% of his minutes, basically from here on out, because otherwise the lineups that they can throw out there as an alternative, they just have no spacing. You know, if you've got Tristan along with Mozgov at the four and five spots, then that's going to be a very congested paint area. And for Kyrie and LeBron, they're not going to be able to have those driving lanes. So I think they have to have a heavy dose of LeBron at the four. And in a lot of ways, look back to what happened to the Heat when Chris Bosh went down in the playoffs. And it ended up being the birth of the small ball pace and space era that, you know, the Heat then used as their blueprint for the next couple of seasons. But it was something that originally came out of necessity from Chris Bosh being out for most of that Pacers series and part of the Celtics series as well. So that's their best hope. But I think that the Cavs really only have six guys that you can count on, and it's going to be tough to make it through three playoff series when you've got a six- or seven-man rotation.
I agree. I think putting LeBron at the four in this series creates matchup issues, especially when you think about where does Jimmy Butler play? How does he guard him? What matchups are created by that domino effect?
Yeah.
So where do you guys go? You guys are going to say Chicago in six, seven?
I think that Cleveland will still win.
I agree.
I think it'll be a tight series, though. I think it'll probably be Cleveland in seven. But the tough thing for Chicago is that in this round, the games go on alternating days. So there's not going to be an opportunity for Derrick Rose to get, you know, 2 or 3 days of rest and recover. So I think that he could come out and have a big game tomorrow night. But as the series goes on, I think you'll see more of those 6-for-17 kind of games, whereas a rested Derrick Rose, whose knees are a little bit less rickety, is still capable of having those big games. So honestly, the difference in this series is if you get two big games out of Derrick Rose, I think that it's tough for the Bulls to win. I think if they get three or four, then I think that they can probably pull it off.
Well, that's a fair point. I think that that's a fair point. I don't know. I mean, Derrick Rose, like you're saying, the more he plays, the more you're going to see defensive lapses. The more you're going to see him putting up shots that really aren't shots he should be taking. I see it as Cleveland in six or seven myself. And honestly, though Cleveland's battered, it's hard for me to see them falling to Atlanta or the Wizards then moving forward after that.
I think that the way that the Wizards have played has really surprised me so far.
Yes.
They're playing the way that I thought they were going to play in the regular season and didn't.
That's true. It's a good point. And a big, big part of it, probably the key part, has been, you know, that they've played Paul Pierce at the four more. They've had more of a small ball lineup. And for the regular season, you know, it seemed like they were favoring more having two conventional big guys out there, whether it was Gortat and Nene, or, you know, also when they were going to the bench, you know, they weren't downsizing all that much. But Paul Pierce, I mean, it's unbelievable that here we are in his, 17th season in the league, something like that, and he's still, of the guys remaining in the playoffs, how many players would you rather have taking a shot in the last 30 seconds of a game other than Paul Pierce?
Yeah, and we were commenting on that, and I think it was the final game against Toronto, that there was a moment at the end of the game where Paul Pierce put it away, and he's still that player where when he takes that shot in a big moment, you know it's going in.
Yeah, and he, to his credit as well, I think has really embraced like the villain role of being like the dream crusher.
Yes.
And did you guys see it was on Instagram or Twitter or something, but he posted that kind of Game of Thrones reference of him like sitting as the king in the north.
Oh, wow.
Like, after the series. But, I mean, he just relished, I think, being able to go in and just crush the dreams of the Raptors fans.
Yeah, when he hit that game-killing shot, I think it was great to then see him, like the Paul Pierce of old, strut around the court for a minute, look at the crowd like Mayweather running around the ring and getting up on the posts and taunting his detractors.
Right, right.
It's pretty great. So he's the heel we like.
Yeah, he's
the heel that...
I think the heels, as they age, become more lovable in a way. You start to appreciate them in a different way.
Absolutely, absolutely that's the case. You see it with Ric Flair.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was a super heel for a long time. You grow to love him. And Paul Pierce is certainly in that mold. And I loved that he was antagonizing those Toronto fans.
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. And that the Wizards just mopped the floor with them was all the better. And that Paul Pierce was such a great leader in it, too. Besides being the heel and the bad guy to Toronto, he was a leader for his team. And I love that about him. I think that he's not always been my favorite player, but you're right. I mean, who would I rather have right now on my team taking shots at this point? Paul Pierce is about it. Obviously, Chris Paul. I wouldn't shy away from LeBron for anything. But
right.
And then Steph Curry.
Yeah.
But those are your four, I think, that – I mean, the 2015 that Paul Pierce is in that discussion is amazing.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing that's been interesting with the Wizards is that Otto Porter, who seemed like he was maybe on his way to being a bust, has had a pretty solid postseason. He's been the other part of enabling them to go small because he's sopping up a lot of those minutes at the four as well. Or sometimes they'll have both him and Pierce out there, and those guys can interchangeably guard threes and fours. So I'm encouraged to see him developing into a nice piece of the puzzle because – you know, the Wizards are a team that they really are one piece away from being a perennial contender in the East. And if he turns into that guy, he could really be a nice third banana for that team.
Oh, I love that. I love that idea of the Wizards as a team that's really up and coming. And like you were saying, Tim, is I think after the playoffs last year, everybody expected real growth from this team in the regular season. And that didn't really happen. But again, we see in the playoffs a lot of times there are players and there are teams that shine brighter when the lights are on and when it's playoff time and crunch time. And John Wall seems like one of those players to me who really – and Bradley Beal. Bradley Beal seems like another player who had a really dreadful first half of the – at least from what I expected from him, rather dreadful first half of the season. And now he's really turned it on and had quite a series.
It's true.
So we could talk about real quickly in the offseason. There were two things that I think that deserve a little bit of attention. For one, I thought that the Bucks were really impressive in pushing Chicago the way they did. And I think they had one of the most incredible seasons for them to have first-year coach Jason Kidd. They were the worst team last year. They lost one of their best defenders in Sanders, who they had to waive. Their big-time signing, their rookie, Jabari Parker, went down after about 20-some games. And yet here they pushed the Chicago Bulls in the first round. I really think it's an interesting team with Michael Carter-Williams more integrated next year and Jabari Parker. How do you guys see Milwaukee going next year?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting team to try to figure out where all the pieces fit once Jabari Parker comes back, what role he plays, how well he and Carter Williams play together in that backcourt.
Yeah, and he's a guy that I think solves a lot of the problems that they had in the playoffs this year, because they've already got a lot of very interesting defensive pieces.
Yes.
But what they don't have is somebody that you can count on to score out of an isolation in a crunch time situation. And he is that guy. And I think that assuming that he makes a full recovery from the injury and is able to, develop in the way that most people expect him to, he's a very polished offensive player who can score from the block. He can score from outside, and all of a sudden gives them that alpha dog type scorer that they've been missing. I think that Giannis will continue to develop. MCW will potentially continue to develop. I mean, it seems like that there's a chance that they're going to be able to turn him into a useful player. They, in a lot of ways, what happened this year was actually what I think some people thought might happen last year. I mean, last year, it's easy to lose track of the fact that even though they were the worst team going into the season, most people expected that they'd be competing for a 7 or 8 seed because they had a lot of useful players and went 9 or 10 deep with quality NBA guys. And they still have, just an interesting assortment of players and have a good ownership structure in place now so that, they could turn into a team like the Wizards that that develops into a perennial Eastern Conference contender if all the pieces develop in the right way. So it's good for the basketball to have more Eastern Conference teams that are intriguing and have bright futures. So hopefully the Bucks will not blow this opportunity.
I think that the comparison to the Wizards is great. It brings up something that I heard both coaches for San Antonio and for the Clippers saying that it wasn't quite fair that they met in the first round of the playoffs. Is that something you guys would change? Would you change the conferences? Would you put everybody into one giant conference and the best 16 teams are in the playoffs?
I don't think that they were suggesting that they should get rid of the conference structure. Mm-hmm. I think the concern that they were raising is about the division structure. And I think I understand that there are people who also think that the conference structure should be done away with. I happen to think the conference structure is fine, but the divisions are meaningless. Nobody cares about winning a divisional title. It means nothing, and the schedules within each conference are balanced. So you're still playing all the teams in your conference the same
amount of
times. So it's not like in baseball where, because of the unbalanced schedule, I mean, you really are playing the teams in your division so often that – it means something to be able to emerge as the best team in that division. I would get rid of the divisions entirely, or just keep them as kind of a symbolic organizing principle, but don't give any kind of seeding preference for them. Because the reality is that the Blazers going into the postseason, everybody knew that the Blazers were a very vulnerable team. And for them to be locked into that 4 seed at the end when a team like San Antonio on the last day of the season dropped from 2 all the way down to 6 because of the way that the division structure works.
That's right.
That just seems sort of silly and counterintuitive. At the end of the day, you have to be able to beat the best teams to move on. So I'm not sure if it's unfair necessarily that they had to play in the first round rather than playing each other in the second round. Both of these teams have championship aspirations, so I don't think that they would suggest that they should have to have an easier path.
That's right.
But from the perspective of having a, you know, a fair and balanced product, I don't think that the divisions make a lot of sense anymore.
They're completely superfluous. As you've pointed out, it's not like they play more games against these division. It's a superfluous, very artificial structure. At least the West and East makes sense. I'm with you. I wouldn't get rid of the conferences. But I think your point about getting rid of the divisions and the way that works, I think that and the automatic seeding, I think that getting rid of that makes a lot of sense. Is it the swan song for these Pistons? Do they sign someone from Portland and continue on as perennial champions, or...
For the Spurs, you mean?
Yeah, for the Spurs. Oh, I'm sorry.
The Pistons. We'll do a whole show just talking about the Pistons
so
offseason, I think.
I don't know where that came from.
I think that it if it is the end, that's a sad thing for basketball to have this great core that's been able to have an unprecedented run of core success over the last 18 years or so. I hope that those guys come back. But the challenging thing is that they've got a unique opportunity this summer to capitalize on having a lot of cap space. And there are some intriguing big men. You mentioned LaMarcus Aldridge. Marc Gasol is also going to be a free agent. Paul Millsap is going to be a free agent. There are some interesting players that would fit very nicely in with what the Spurs do. And I would not be at all surprised, though, to see Duncan come back on a below market deal, kind of like what Dirk did in Dallas, to say, listen, who do we think we can bring in? What do we need to do it? We'll structure my contract in a way to let that happen. But you watched him play in this series, and it's not like it seems like he is on his last legs.
Oh, gosh, no.
There are no indications, especially with the way that Pop has managed him over these past few seasons and managed his minutes and his games, there's no indication that he can't do this for another year.
He could, for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
even,
I could see it for 2 or 3 years, absolutely. It was amazing. He was guarding 26-year-olds and 27-year-olds and handling it pretty well. In that game 5, in fact, Blake Griffin was the one who looked winded and not Tim Duncan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
It was pretty neat. It was pretty neat to see, and I've never been a Tim Duncan fan until the last few years. Again, the heel, even though he's a boring heel, but as he gets a little older, he becomes, I like him more and more. I like the way he plays. And, you know, this year, too, I think we've seen real enthusiasm from him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem like a savant out there who can just play and a robot who doesn't do anything, but he seems like he's having fun and he seems like he enjoys his teammates.
Yeah. And right now I'm looking at Kareem's age 39 season, and Kareem, who I think is probably the closest analog in terms of longevity to Tim Duncan, he in his 39 season averaged 17 points per game. Wow. And a little under 7 rebounds. Honestly, I think that, that's basically what Tim Duncan, Tim Duncan had better rebounding stats, but in terms of the scoring, Tim Duncan easily, you can count on in a playoff series for him to give you that 17, 18 points. Kareem ended up playing until he was 41, and I think that Duncan, if he wanted to, could play for another 1, 2, 3 seasons. The question just becomes, what does he feel like he has to prove to himself at this point? Mm-hmm. Does getting that 6th ring and being able to enter the conversation with those Jordan Bulls teams in terms of being in that elite group that was able to get 6 rings with the same core, if that means something to him, then I think he comes back. But honestly, I'm not sure if it does. I don't think that he's like a Kobe who's single-minded in his pursuit of other players. I think part of what makes Duncan so interesting is that you very rarely see him either discussing himself or contextualizing his accomplishments or the Spurs' accomplishments in comparison to any other team, current or past. It's like they exist within this little vacuum of their own accomplishments. And maybe that's part of their success, is that they have not focused on chasing history. They've just been chasing greatness.
Boy, that's a really good point. The one thing I do see, though, is he's having fun. And so it could be that the fun and just the enjoyment, and like you pointed out off the air before we started recording, Tim, those paychecks can be kind of difficult to turn down, even one that's a little bit lower and structured down. Tim Duncan, I mean, he gets to go have fun and play basketball and maybe chase greatness. I think he obviously comes back, but it's neat, like you're saying, though, he wouldn't even really talk about that. Most every other player would have been saying, I'm coming back by now, or I'm not coming back, and this is it. And instead, he's like, I know the time's around, but I don't want to talk about it right now. And that's really admirable to me. I just really have grown to love Tim Duncan.
And the thing we have to keep in mind as well is that we see these players on the court, and we focus on their accomplishments, we look at their stats, we see the team records. But at the end of the day, playing for, you know, competitive basketball for two decades and having lengthy postseason runs in almost every one of those seasons, his body has taken a lot of damage over the years. And even with the minutes managed by Pop, I don't think any of us can even begin to comprehend just the physical toll that that takes on someone and what his body feels like. Just when he wakes up in the morning. And I'm not talking about after Game 7. I mean, on a random Wednesday in July, you wake up and I think that you still feel all of those minutes. So to me, I think that it's going to be a question of, does he want to put his body through that, or is he ready to just, you know, ride off into the sunset and enjoy, you know, a well-earned break from the tolls that he's put on his body. But I will be very sad if this is the end of the run. I would love to see Tim Duncan back next year.
No, I'm with you. And I think that can do it. I would love to sit around and talk with you gentlemen for hours more, but we've really had a great show here today on Can't Wait. For Tim and Matt Milner, I'm Rusty Boulay-Stevenson, and we're going to keep doing this until somebody tells us not to. Thanks for tuning in.